Okay, we're going to be talking about Mark chapter 7, verses 1 through 23, and the topic is traditions. So, Mark chapter 7 is at the center of a unit that goes from chapter 6 through chapter 8. Chapter 6 opened with Jesus' rejection in Nazareth and his sending out of the apostles. And then that story was interrupted by the account of John the Baptist's execution, in which was asked the question, who is Jesus? And upon their return, the feeding of the 5,000 in Jewish territory occurs. Chapter 8 is going to close this unit with the feeding of the 4,000 in Gentile territory. And Jesus asks his disciples, who am I? So this chapter 7, in the center of these stories, it discusses traditions surrounding Jewish ritual purity and a story about Gentile woman. So this entire unit serves to reveal what purity or holiness means and who is included in God's kingdom. We need to be careful when reading today's passage. It's sometimes been used to justify anti-Semitism, or at the very least to denigrate Judaism. It's been used by the so-called low church Christians to unfairly attack Christians who value and practice much more ritualized forms of Christianity. It's been used by one Christian group to criticize other groups who don't belong for beliefs and practices that maybe the first don't believe in or practice. So it's kind of, this first part of chapter 7 contains a lot of so-called proof texts that have been thrown around throughout the centuries. So as we read through some of these passages, some questions that we ought to keep in mind: are all traditions bad? And what exactly does Jesus and/or Mark mean by this term, by the term traditions? What is Jesus, what is Mark attempting to communicate about the concepts of purity and holiness? And what did Jesus and Mark mean when he writes, thus he declared all foods clean? So, let's see, we'll read the first 7 verses here, which opens this particular episode. Now when the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders, and when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. And the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands? And he, Jesus, said to them, well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.
Washing your hands before you eat, and washing your dishes, those are sensible things.
Okay. So what's the setting, and who is present?
It's all the rich people that are saying that these poor people can't come sit with us and eat because they're dirty, kind of? Is that kind of the overall?
Part of it.
I don't know if they're rich or
part
not.
Part of
but
it,
I mean,
but there's the ritual, all the ritual washings that they do before, in order to be
pure before the
Lord. Yeah, pure before the Lord.
So, this is a gathering of the Pharisees with some, with Jesus and some of his disciples.
So, they're all Jews. They're all assumed to follow the Jewish rules.
So, well, yeah, at the same time, there's something, you know, Mark mentions specifically that some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem.
Okay. So like having the church leaders from Anchorage in town. Or something. Maybe?
Well, the Pharisee, it's a controversy. The controversy in Mark is always between Jesus and those from Jerusalem. So it is a dinner setting, some kind of a meal. Now those in Galilee, those from Galilee, would probably not be as observant of the traditions as would the Judeans, especially those that were in Jerusalem.
So the Jerusalem, the scribes from Jerusalem, make sure and observe all the purity laws.
Right, the scribes. The scribes are a subset of the Pharisees.
Okay.
The scribes were the interpreters. They were the experts of the law. So what is this? What is the controversy?
About whether or not you must wash your hands before you eat?
Well, that would seem to be on the surface, but is there more, you know, is that the real problem? Is there more to it?
Well, that's probably simply an example of
why does Mark include this extremely lengthy parenthetical explanation for the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches.
He's making sure the reader knows, because the reader might not already know.
Mark's audience is not Jewish.
Okay. So the reader doesn't necessarily know about all of the ritual purity regulations.
But the conflict that Mark is trying to show, is he trying to show it for his readers to see that, or is he actually trying to show and show something that's happened that's a problem rather than just giving people context to go off of?
What's the problem with washing?
There's not a problem with washing. But when you're making the law more important than the people...
So, the ritual of washing hands, you're supposed to... What is it? What did they do? It was an elaborate ritual because the whole idea is that the world contaminates you. And so you're supposed to wash first, think you drip you're actually not washing. It's more of dripping water. And you let it
drip. And you let it run down your hands to your elbows.
And then you... Right. And then, because that has been contaminated, that's contaminated water, now you have to drip all of that back down.
Whoa.
With more water.
And usually somebody's doing it to you, right? Like, you're not... Is there, like, status thing where you're having...
Maybe there's a servant.
Yeah.
That's... So, Jewish homes, especially the observant ones, would have these huge clay, you know, water pots.
Yeah. Now, was that extravagant? Was that a lavish thing to do at that time?
No.
No,
it was expected of all Jews.
Uh-huh.
Now, not all probably did it all the time. Mark also included that little explanation about marketplace. So going to the marketplace contaminates you.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so there's another elaborate washing ritual that must take place after returning from the marketplace.
Because the marketplace is like evil or something. Because it's the world. Not because there's bacteria.
It has nothing to do with health.
I know. Wow. But it makes sense. It makes sense from our point of view. But they're not doing it for our reasons. They're doing it for...
Mm-hmm.
So that they can be pure before God.
So Jesus responded with a quotation from Isaiah. This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.
Uh-huh.
What's the point Jesus is making here?
That people are using their own rules as his word. And they're just basically like saying, well, these are what rituals and standards we want to adhere to, and so the rest of society should do this, and we're the voice of God in our society, so you should follow us.
Yeah. So in Jewish history, as going all the way back to Exodus and specifically Sinai, where God gives the law, he commands that the priests be particularly holy, but at the same time, the entire camp, all of the people are expected to be holy.
Uh-huh.
They are expected to be clean and undefiled.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all these ritual washings were originally only applicable to the priests, but as time went on, the interpretation of God wants us to be holy, especially post-exile from Babylon.
Right.
If God wants us to be holy, then why don't we follow the laws and regulations that were given to the priests?
So everyone should act like a priest.
So,
priesthood of all believers?
So is there anything wrong with that?
Well, most people that live in the real world that don't live in a monastery can't really devote their whole lives to taking one step backward every time they go forward to do something every day. I mean, that'd be like if you were a devout Christian and you wanted to pray every single time before you threw your net in the water to make sure you caught fish, I mean... But had to, like, stop and dance around the deck a few times this way and that way and back again, you'd never get anything done. But, I mean, that's only the sarcastic.
Well, they're putting an unnecessary burden on the common people and telling them that God requires it of them.
Well, more so even an obtainable statute to live up to also. I mean, mm-hmm. most priests mm-hmm. that are practicing their religion are doing just exactly that. They're practicing it to their best ability, but it's not like you can completely be the holiest of holies.
As in, the priest might not be actually perfect either, but...
Well, no, we need to go back to the people's mindset of this time. The command was for the people to be holy. And because they had failed to keep the laws,
right,
they had been taken into exile into Babylon.
And the exile was a punishment, at least from their point of view, for not obeying the law well enough. And so they're saying, okay, we need to obey the law really, really well, and everybody should.
And the general
requirements that right. used to be from the, for the priest.
And the kind of a popular thought teaching at the time, not just Pharisees, but among a great number of Jews, was that if all Jews kept the law perfectly for one day, the Messiah would come.
If all the Jews are perfect, then we can bring about... You hear that today, too. We need to live so as to bring about the second coming of Jesus. And
all the corners have been reached.
That's a common theme today, but... So if all Jews kept the law perfectly for one day, oh my goodness, then the Messiah would come. So
no pressure.
So why are you guys not being keeping the law perfectly here?
And the disciples were not just ordinary Jews.
They were... assumed to be a higher level.
They were followers of a rabbi. And that is what... See, they're not questioning the disciples. By supposedly raising the question about the disciples, the scribes are directly accusing Jesus of not being a proper rabbi.
I see.
That makes sense.
So that was the conflict then, is that by directing their critique at the disciples, they were directly critiquing...
They were accusing Jesus of not being a good teacher.
A good Jew.
Jesus is undermining the entire basis for Jewish society.
Right, which he has been for a long time.
It's no surprise, but that's one reason why
the
scribes would come from Jerusalem.
To see this.
Yeah.
To critique and...
To nip communism in the butt before it got any further. I see. Yeah.
Jesus was, in some of their minds, a danger...
Absolutely,
society.
To your structured view of existence and your God.
He was.
Basically you're being told you're given another God right now. And if you've adhered to this level, we've been talking about that for a long time, because what Christ is saying is he's trying to abolish the ability for one man to gauge another man's relationship with God by knowing his status of his intellect of the law, or his will to adhere to their standards of doctrine.
People like to look at how well people obey the rules and judge whether or not
they love their report cards.
A good Christian.
Jesus responds with a quotation from Isaiah. And the next two parts will kind of explain what Jesus intends by this. So the first rebuttal, Jesus turns the accusation around and saying to them that their traditions are bad.
Yeah.
So verses 8 through 13. You leave the commandments of God and hold the traditions of men. And he said to them, you have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition. For Moses said, honor your father and your mother, and whoever reviles father or mother must surely die. But you say, if a man tells his father or his mother, whatever you would have gained from me is korban, that is, given to God, then you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or mother, thus making void the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. And many such things you do.
Uh-huh. So they've learned to find a loophole?
They like their loopholes, don't they?
So,
by using tradition by, as yeah, by God's will.
Second and third century or so A.D., all of these oral traditions are going to be written down.
Uh-huh.
Right now, these are all oral.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there's said to be, what is it, 713 laws.
But is there disagreement about what is included in the
certainly, 713? Certainly, there are. There were schools of rabbinical thought that, you know, debated back and forth. What exactly?
So it's all of the parodies, like the all of the comedy parodies of the rabbi walking through old Jew town, New York or something, and the guy coming up and being like, should I buy my wife a diamond ring for engagement and should it be lavish or something like that? And the rabbi says, well, does she need a big diamond ring? Is she responsible? Is it for her safety and for her well-being if something happens to you? Or is it because she's a gold digger or something like that, he asks. Or the guy says, hey, I want to get a new Lexus, but I can't really tell my wife about it, but we want it. So the guy finds a way to say it so that it makes sense that it should be done rather than... It's a parody, and they're always making a parody of their Jewish faith when they do that. But they're making it so that the rabbi is always making it so that you must hurt your wife in order to get something that you need. So it's important. You have to do
it's
this.
It's all about finding a way to obey the laws and get what you want.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So.
And that's what Jesus is attacking.
Yeah. So there were a number of schools of thought in Judaism. Pharisaism is one. You have Sadducees on another point. And those are the two groups that seem to be most in conflict with Jesus in the Gospels. But there is also the Essenes, which we don't
hear a lot about
in the Bible. Hmm. Actually, we don't hear at all in the Bible.
No.
But they were even more extreme about purity.
I see.
They lived... That's where the Qumran community comes from. The Qumran community in the Essenes where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found.
Hmm.
Uh-huh. But they all believe that they were, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Essenes, Jesus, they were all, the debate was about what does it mean to keep the law?
Right.
What is the law?
Uh-huh.
That's the basic question that is being asked by all of them.
Uh-huh. And is Jesus deviating from that question?
No, Jesus is asking the same question.
He's staying with the same question.
But his answer...
His response is quite different.
Right. Uh-huh. His response to the law has always been a roundabout way of saying it's simple. It's simply to create a relationship with
So right here in verse 9, Jesus said to them, you have a fine way of rejecting the commandment.
Right.
Definite article, singular. Uh-huh. The commandment of God.
Uh-huh.
In order to establish your tradition. So, this is the first rebuttal, that his opponents are placing man-made traditions over the commandment of God. Uh-huh. No, so what is Jesus saying? What is the commandment that Jesus is concerned about?
Well, so many times we've gone over it, but it's always been to create... It's always been to create a relationship with God. Uh-huh. But it's always been said so many different ways and so wordy that I can't remember the one way to say it.
Is it basically the love the Lord your God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself? Is that the commandment he's talking about?
There's not even a what and. It's usually just a pretty much like... Uh-huh. Your commandment is to just have the relationship with God.
So Jesus doesn't leave it there. He gives an example. It says, "For Moses said, honor your father and your mother." So that comes from the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. And whoever reviles father or mother must surely die. That comes from another part. Well, it's not part of the Ten Commandments, but it was part of the law that was given at Sinai. So he gives that as law. But you say, if a man tells his father or his mother, whatever you would have gained from me is korban, that is, given to God, then you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or mother, thus making void the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. Now, this example involving the honoring of parents and finding a way to not honor your parents, most scholars today believe that this is hypothetical more than it was real. It probably didn't actually happen, but it is something that could have easily been explained away. The fifth commandment could have been explained away.
In other words, any commandment, even something as obvious as honoring your father and mother, you explain away whenever you feel like it.
So korban is a gift that is dedicated to God. So a son might say, all this inheritance that I am going to get, or all this that I already have, is now dedicated to God. At that point, then, it can no longer be used for any other purpose.
As in, a rule kicks in that they're not allowed to help their parents anymore.
But the person making the gift can use it for himself.
Weird.
Not yours.
He can use it for himself, but...
As long as he's alive, he can use it for himself, but he cannot use it for anything else, because all that is left at his death then goes to the temple.
I see. In other words, it's the assumption that he'll use it, but he'll only use as much as he needs, and so everything other than what he actually needs goes to the temple. That seems like a noble thing.
Except if your parents are starving.
Except when you're telling your parents, no, I'm not going to help you anymore because all that I can use it for is just for me.
Sounds like it's more a direct shot at mothers, because it's usually the father that dies and the son inherits the
Still alive, he's more likely to be able to have an occupation. If the mother is still alive, then she is more likely to rely on her children.
So what's going on here is that Ten Commandments, the laws given at Sinai, says that you must honor your familial relationships.
Yes.
The traditions of the scribes say that you must honor your commitment to God before right. your familiar,
right.
familial obligations.
Right.
Uh-huh. I mean, what's more honorable than honoring, placing God first in your life?
Right.
Well, yeah, but when you're placing God first in her, and in doing so, neglecting your personal responsibilities, then you're not placing God first.
So you might think that, you know, kind of this rebuttal seems a little off topic. The original accusation was about ritual purity,
uh-huh.
about washing hands,
uh-huh.
or eating, about cleanliness, or at least ritual purity, ritual cleanliness,
uh-huh.
and holiness. Does this, that Jesus' digression, it seems like, into honoring your father and mother.
He's a little off topic here, seems
Is he off
like?
Topic?
Well, he's saying you've perverted what God asked. You've taken the things God asked you to do and perverted them so they don't mean what they did, what they meant. You've taken them and made them mean wrongly.
Is he not done explaining why he's going way off the subject yet?
No, he's not done. He's the second part. In the second part of this rebuttal, he talks about what defilement really is, genuine defilement.
Ah, what is defilement?
So verses 14 through 23. And he called the people to him again and said to them, "Hear me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of a person are what defile him."
Uh-huh.
And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. And he said to them, "Then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and is expelled? Thus he declared all foods clean." That's a parenthetical statement by Mark.
Yes.
It's an editorial comment. And he said, now back to Jesus, and he said, "What comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, comes evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person."
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So he's saying that what you get on you does not defile you. It's not about germs, in other words.
Or it's
media.
Or it's not about
mm-hmm.
the idea
yeah.
that somehow you can be defiled by
being in the world.
Being in contact with an unclean
mm-hmm.
person or an unclean object or an unclean piece of food.
Or, I don't know, watching an unclean movie.
Any of it.
That's not what defiles you. What defiles you is what comes out of you, not what goes into you.
Though Jesus does return to the original topic of ritual purity and of holiness, what it means to be holy, and responds with a parable. So what is it that causes defilement in the law? In the law that was given at Sinai, what caused defilement?
What causes defilement in the law?
According to the law,
I don't know.
Contact with anything that is
unclean
or common.
Uh-huh.
Or, no, priests in particular were prohibited from a lot of common things.
Uh-huh.
Because impurity could be transmitted.
Uh-huh. So they were required to stay apart from the world. To prevent
and among those things that would be unclean would be people, groups.
Uh-huh.
Non-Jews were unclean.
Uh-huh.
So to be in contact, and in first century Palestine,
uh-huh.
Now, going outside meant you would be in contact with Romans, Gentiles, barbarians. No, barbarians not in uncivilized, but non-Roman or non-Gentile.
Right.
Non-Greek would be barbarians.
Right.
Right.
And because ritual impurity is transmitted from a person to an object touched by an unclean person, a Gentile would be unclean, and if a Jew touched that object, the Jew would become ritually impure. Hence,
all object which might have been,
or might have been, or no, if you want to take it to the extreme, if you walked on the same places.
So, in other words, in order to stay ritually pure, you have to very studiously avoid common people and anything.
And
that,
water,
you have to have an absolute standard of.
And
of,
wash all the time.
Yeah. And you're not washing all the time. You're not washing. You're literally adhering to your prejudice of all other people, types, likes, and things to do so to keep clean.
And some of the ritual impurities weren't expunged simply by washing your hands. Some of the things required more than that.
Yeah,
you had to be really, really careful.
Touching a dead body, you know, there were elaborate rituals to me. Because
that took like a week or something.
Death was considered the ultimate impurity.
But see, that kind
you were
of
unclean for a long time
that
after that.
That kind of severe superstitious attitude is what locks people into societies that don't move very fast. Your technologies, your lifestyles, your
day is spent trying to make sure you don't touch them.
Everything that you're doing has to have a ritual to it. You're not going to get your society's not going to advance very quickly.
Well, and are you going to be able to be part of the community and love the people in the community?
No, because you're going to have to make sure you go through your flight check before you,
they touched.
Before you eat dinner with your wife, let alone anything else.
Let alone walking through the grocery store.
That would be agonizing.
Yeah.
How come they didn't just all move to a whole new world?
Well, they did. They called it Canaan. They conquered it. But
well, then how come they didn't just build a wall and never let anybody ever in it ever again? Bring only their purest food of grain with them.
The Essenes tried.
They did.
They did.
They did try to banish themselves.
To live apart. Yeah. Completely.
Okay.
In fact, a few Essene communities forbade women. Because women, you know,
are impure.
Were impure. Or at least they had periods.
I bet they died off really fast.
Sort of intended.
Yes.
Impure.
Yeah.
Huh. Those guys were really, really devout.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just see how, like, that type of mentality just limits your ability to observe this grandeur of the world. Like, if everything's impure.
If this kind of tradition continued, where would where would Jesus's, where would the gospel be?
Nowhere.
It would be isolated in a little cult.
No, it would have grown to where every religion in the world was still stuck basically in their own little steeped traditions that you can't go beyond or past them.
Yeah.
It's still like that a lot. People want that.
People want to live apart and be, and especially parents want to keep their children isolated from the world.
Well, just people want there's a lot in the Bible in the beginning where they were constantly asking for a king again, right? Like where God kept telling them, you don't need a king, just you know, you're something about the people constantly needing a king, and it always biting them every time because they couldn't govern themselves and they couldn't keep to themselves and take care of each other, so they needed a king.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing here, where Christ is trying to say that, look, you're missing the picture here. You can give yourself freedom, because that's got to be really restraining, to be stuck in a world where you have to constantly, like I said, dance on your toe, turn three times, twice, and then move to the next segment.
So the law says, you know, you have to be separate from all of these things to remain pure and holy. What does Jesus say causes defilement?
What comes out?
What you do.
You know, what you think, what you do.
Uh-huh.
And so evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. How does anybody not have any of those things happen to them? Coming out someday.
Good question. What is maybe Jesus saying?
That it's not possible.
No one is clean.
Right.
No one is pure. No one is holy. He is saying,
contrary to
we Jews, no, you Jews cannot be holy. You are the same as the Gentiles.
Yeah.
Your goal of being perfect for a day, everyone all at once, is not attainable. And
that, and it's interesting that, you know, the list of things here, you know, some of them are maybe they don't directly involve another person, but all of these things indirectly are something about self. Okay, it's about self aggrandizement. It's trying to make yourself better at the expense of another.
Uh-huh.
Or you are hurting someone in order to get what you want. Notice that nothing in the list Jesus gives has anything to do with worship or religion or God.
Ah. So does that mean that worshiping wrongly can't make you unclean? Or does that mean that worshiping rightly cannot make you clean? Does that actually mean that worship cannot clean you?
Well, I'm sure it can mean many different things.
He hasn't got to the worship part yet.
Well, there's nothing about worship here. No. These are the things that make, that defile a person.
So he's not addressing that issue in this time then.
Yeah. He's saying, here are the things that defile a person. It's your actions. It's
see, in the first rebuttal, the first half of the rebuttal, Jesus contrasted law with tradition. And the law that Jesus chose to highlight is one that specifically has to do with relationships.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the tradition that went against it was one that supposedly honored God.
Mm-hmm.
And so it goes then directly to Isaiah's passage that Jesus quoted. This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.
Yeah.
Worship has nothing to do with honoring God.
No.
Huh.
What really? Jesus is getting, the point I think Jesus is getting to is that how you treat one another is how you honor God. Now, by treating one another ethically, with respect, and with honor and love, that is how you worship and honor God.
You worship and honor God by taking care of your parents.
Yeah. So then we get to this little parenthetical editorial comment by Mark. Thus he declared all foods clean, and it's been a source of discussion and controversy among some groups.
Especially like Adventists.
But not even, not just Adventists. Throughout Christendom, this has been debated. So did Jesus really mean, did Mark really mean that when Jesus said that nothing going in can defile, did Jesus really mean that all foods are clean?
I think he meant that that's not the issue.
There's plenty of cultures that drink blood and are still alive and have really high longevity life rate. Mm-hmm. So I think he meant nothing to the effect of whether or not food was good or good or bad health-wise for you, which is why everybody now says that they shouldn't eat one food or the other.
Right. People try to make it healthy.
It nothing in that concern whatsoever. Yeah. It meant that as you as a Christian sit down at a table of a brother, which is another man of this world that's under the light of God, who should be treated as such, you can now sit at his table and eat with him what he eats when he eats it, and have a relationship with that person.
That person is unclean. Because
that's all that he meant. He was not talking about health concerns. He didn't care if you were going to get cancer from eating pork, because back then pigs ate natural food products and they weren't going to give you freaking cancer because it didn't matter. That's not what they were worried about.
The Jewish ritual, the ritual laws regarding food had nothing to do with health.
Nothing.
No, I don't care what.
There's no way in this world that you're ever going to convince me that what they were eating or not eating had anything to do with the health concerns.
Yeah, these were not health laws. They were ritual purity laws that separated the Hebrews, the Israelites, from the Canaanites.
And the only time that Christ or John talked about, I think it was John, might have been one of the other ones, talked about not eating food, it was because it was given to him as a gift from another god. Like
it was food that had been offered to the god, and so
it was food that was to strengthen him from the will of the other god, or something like that. That's
and
the only
so
time. And then he did
it. And so if he ate it in that setting, he would be acknowledging to the people around him that he respected that God.
Right, and that's the only time I think that I've ever heard
And in other settings, Paul says, it's not a big deal. You can eat it, it's okay.
Right.
But in some settings...
But this is a direct time when Christ is... Mark is writing about this directly happening with Christ at this time.
Right.
Because Paul was writing about himself, or...
Right, he was writing it about himself.
It was Paul then?
I think it was Paul.
Okay.
Eating it in some situations and not eating it in other situations, depending on who he's with and what the situation is.
Yeah, let's suppose that Christians were required to continue to observe Jewish food purity laws.
Right.
What would it do for... the gospel, the evangelism.
Well, it would immediately, detach Christians from almost every other culture and society. There's no way you're going to go to. There's no way you're going to go to almost any country and not end up eating. A slimy freshwater fish that has no scales. You're not gonna end up somewhere where you're gonna end up eating a pig you're going to end up somewhere where the cultures and people are eating.
Yeah. What's interesting, what is different about Christianity as it would develop at the time, in its very early stages, is that all the other religions, they really didn't do much, if any, proselytizing. They weren't trying to convert people.
Right.
They didn't go out to explicitly convert.
No, they actually tried to grow within each other.
With Judaism, if someone wanted to come in, certainly they were welcome to do so. But the Jews were not going out.
Right.
You know, trying to convert Romans and Greeks into Judaism.
Mm-hmm. And this period of time marks a transition where they are doing
but that. The reason why Christianity was trying to quote unquote recruit people was because they didn't actually feel and Christ didn't come here to recruit people. He came to rescue people. To rescue them from themselves and from their oppressions and from their tyrannies of leaders that had moral compass as to how they were going to treat life.
All the other cultures, religions, nationalities, ethnicities, tribes, they were essentially tribal. They tried to keep to themselves. They had their distinct identifying markers that they tried to keep.
Very distinct.
Christianity is very different in that its mission is to go out and mingle.
Yeah.
And ritual purity laws would be a formidable barrier to one of the fundamental tenets of this new way.
Yeah. Christians were the hippies of their time. Well, in a way, because they're asking the societies of their time to undress and run around naked in public. I mean, they're
asking them to give up their rules about what holds you together as a society.
Right.
And Christianity gives up quite a lot of those things.
Well, boundaries have never been something that people have been able to adhere to without some sort of strict regulatory action or reason behind them. Societies never even once been able to say, yeah, you may not want to do that, but we're not going to tell you not to. You know, it's always been like, there's always got to be defined lines of
it can start out with, yes, here's something that's good for society, but then if you have to make everybody do it, you have to...
It's like everything else. You go out right now and there's fisheries out right now. There's things that people can do in the public right now that have absolutely no regulatory guidelines whatsoever because of the amount of people that are involved in doing it, or the impact of that action on the certain resource doesn't amount to anything yet. But as soon as a collective effort of people comes together to do a certain action, there becomes time when it starts to become organized,
and
as soon as people start organizing something into whatever it is they're doing, there suddenly has to be the pecking order and fault lines or whatever that people have to follow. It's almost an inevitability in which no man is capable of avoiding, no matter how well-intended their actions may be. I mean, it just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen at all. I don't care what you're doing. Everybody ends up with a freaking council and a purser and a president and something else.
Whether or not you want it.
So that's the end of the passage. A few questions to think about here. Are all traditions bad?
No.
Well, absolutely not, no.
So, what makes a tradition bad? What is it? What's a good tradition? What are characteristics of a good tradition?
Something that enhances your personal life. Something that enhances the way you live.
It's optional.
Personal. Yeah.
Optional.
Yeah, once you try to enforce a tradition and tell a whole group of people that they have to follow it, then it becomes something else.
I think arranged marriages inside your own ethnic and creed are great traditions that should be...
Well, I mean, Jesus kept many Jewish traditions. He kept traditions of the feasts.
Uh-huh.
You know, he even celebrated, Purim.
Uh-huh.
So the party.
Purim definitely
keeps the party.
Right? Keeps the fun stuff.
Well, he kept the things that he saw value in, basically.
Well, and what are those things that have value?
The things that build community and bring each other together.
Yeah. And
so celebrations are guaranteed for bringing community together and...
Calling your neighbor dirty and you can't walk where you walk or eat what they eat is probably not good.
Doesn't community. Bring community together so much.
He's
yeah.
Jesus is against divisive traditions.
That makes sense.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
He is against traditions that promote elitism.
Right.
Of one group over another.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
That's why you like the party. That's cool.
Uh-huh.
I'm a
follower of Jesus. I go to parties.
So, is God holy?
Sure.
Was Jesus holy?
Sure.
So, how does holiness manifest?
How does holiness manifest?
You know, in...
In many ways,
holiness is described as almost this unapproachable thing.
No.
God is unapproachable because He is so holy.
But it's
having a higher purpose.
It doesn't look to me in what all of Paul and what all of the stuff with John and the readings that we read, it does not look to me that holiness is obtained or shown in an individual manner in any way, shape, or form. It shows itself in a community and a group it's always multi person effect.
Yeah.
It never shows in this, this one person's holy, because it doesn't. Because usually the people that manifest a sense of holiness are touching a large majority of people, and they their lives are part of each other's lives, and that creates a holy effect. But I don't think if in their definition it was possible for a singular individual to create holiness.
If holiness is the goal, maybe it doesn't happen so much as if you are just following God and doing what's right. Then maybe holiness happens.
If
the holiness itself isn't the actual goal. If you're just doing what's right in the society you live in.
It's interesting that what is often emphasized is this, because holiness means is set apart.
Yes. But in what way? Does it mean set apart as in not touching the people around you?
Well, that's not a goal that we're supposed to obtain. Then, if holiness is something that sets us apart,
kind of the evangelical Christian circles is that God is so holy that sinners cannot approach Him.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, so in order to approach God, you need to confess and repent and
become holy?
Become holy in order to approach God.
Well,
I don't know if the holy, as far as set apart, means that you're not supposed to be, you're not allowed, because basically it's all contradictory, because if Christ...
I don't think holiness means that.
Well, if Christ is trying to say that your relationship is the most important thing between you and God, but God is holy, the holiness part, as far as I can't come to you, would be contradictory.
So Jesus...
That wouldn't make sense.
Jesus was holy when he was walking...
Jesus was holy, and he touched the lepers, and
he touched the sinners.
He touched the sinners.
So
he associated in crowded environments with nasty people.
So, and was based on that, it would be difficult to say that holiness cannot tolerate sin.
Right.
You know, now, the excuse or explanation that is frequently made is that, oh, well, God's divinity and holiness was veiled by humanity. And so that's why...
Humanity was on the outside.
And so that's why people approach Jesus.
That's why I keep saying that most people that have have a problem with religion or Christianity in a way, because the dang thing's bipolar all the time. But it's not the, it's not Christ and God and the righteous. Yay! Biggie Big, look at you. It's not that God's having the problem, it's the interpretations of man that's continuing to pervert something.
Yeah, that's weird. People were touching the humanity part.
And
the God part was...
Kind of in Christianity, it's often been that God's holiness and God's love have been pitted against each other.
Right.
Uh-huh. You know, they're fighting.
God's love compelled him to...
Be nice to you, but he's so big and so holy that he has to crush you when he can. Right? I mean, that's kind of what...
What if they are really the same thing?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Because it was God's holiness... And God's love, both that compelled God
to become
human.
Yeah.
And to become human.
See, man is constantly doing, and he's been doing then, is going against the one commandment. And the one commandment is to simply have a relationship with God. It isn't... There's no other commandment. There's no other you have to do it this way to have a relationship with me. There's no, if you don't have a relationship with me, it looks like this. Or if you do, or it's just you have to have a relationship with me. And if God is unattainable, then you can't have a relationship. But man is constantly trying to create the protocol, quote unquote, for having that relationship with God. They're trying to make up the rules of how they're supposed to have a relationship with God.
So, why have a relationship with God?
What does...
And so people say, okay, let's make a list.
So, what does Jesus' actions tell you about having a relationship with God?
A lot of sighing goes on.
A lot of sighing.
A lot of, like, all right, I'm not going to listen.
Who takes the initiative?
God.
Man is trying to say we can do this, but
saying be my friend, he's just saying let me be your friend.
No, he's saying I am.
Uh-huh.
I am your friend.
Period.
Nothing else. No, I'm your friend when you see me in the light of the moon on the harvest night of the 8th year of your son.
Stern's day.
You know, Stern's day. You know, it's nothing like that. None of it is like that. But man seeks to have his... When Christians do that, all they're doing is saying to other people that we want to make this harder for you.
Uh-huh.
Because
God likes you now. Here's the list.
So... do Christians have rituals?
Very many.
Yeah.
Very many.
Do we have ritual washings?
Yes. We have baptisms.
Well, very definitely baptism, unless you're Salvation Army, in which case you don't.
Yes, they have baptism, certainly.
They have the washes of feet thing.
Yeah.
Certain.
Are there any metaphorical washings?
We're talking about kind of the literal ritual washings.
Oh, okay.
They have.
Got it.
Yeah.
I mean, things that we do to try and purify ourselves from the people around us. Yeah.
We have the holy water thing, like.
Yeah, there's holy water and the.
So yes, we've got ritual
washings. So we definitely have ritual washings. I mean, is that a bad thing?
Not necessarily. The ceremonies can have deep and beautiful meanings. You can see God in them.
So here's I have just one quote this time.
Okay.
This commentary, Feasting in the Gospels, the Gospel of Mark. Though baptism has long been associated with cleansing and forgiveness of sin, it has for just as long been associated with the deeply unclean death of Jesus. When we are baptized, we are joined to Jesus' death as well as his resurrection. Romans chapter 6. Thus, baptism does not remove us from the stains of the world, but joins us to blood, dirt, and anguish, and to all those whom the world regards as unclean.
Huh. Interesting. We tend to think of it as washing things off. Maybe even washing the world off.
But that's, no. Baptism, I mean, I said that because that's what baptism's never been a washing. It just had to do with water, so I said it. But a baptism's always been a declaration of your commitment to something. That's what a baptism's always
been. It is a declaration, but in most Christian traditions, it's also a washing away of sins.
People do talk
about
it.
They missed it then, because that's not what they were doing.
They missed it.
Yep. Well, but people do talk about it that way, but
no, because the baptism was always, we've had this conversation about baptizing an infant. There's no way you can baptize something that has no idea what it's being baptized
for. Well, in the traditions that do it, specifically the Catholic tradition, it's the washing away of original sin.
Original sin. I see.
What I got from being baptized and understanding it was that I was declaring to the world that I was now, because it's you've gone away from who you are then, and you've come back as somebody else now. Uh-huh. And it wasn't a washing per se. It was like a rite of passage. It was like a rite of passage. It was like you can't do this until you've known of something different or whatever. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And with the crucifixion, with baptism being linked to the cross, it's a death and rebirth.
Yeah.
If the idea of holiness as being completely apart from the unclean and the defiled was so important to God, the incarnation would never have happened.
Uh-huh.
The incarnation meaning Jesus.
When
Jesus chose to become human, he chose to join with the unclean,
humanity.
With the defiled.
Uh-huh.
So holiness, genuine holiness, I think what this story is trying to tell us, is that genuine holiness seeks to join those that are unclean and those that are defiled. Because what we have seen in earlier Mark is that when Jesus touches the unclean, they become clean.
Uh-huh.
Right.
When Jesus touches the diseased, they are made whole.
Uh-huh.
And that is genuine holiness.
So that just leaves another big freaking window for people to run around and say, I've just made you clean, we're holy now. Because a lot of people have a lot of real desire to say that they're clean, and so in order to clean people, they need to be holy. So in order to be clean, they need to, or in order to be holy, they need to clean people. So how do we be clean? So then they run out and make a whole nother big list of rules
that
for being
like
clean.
Fun. Oh, yeah. But Jesus said that...
Not that I'm not disregarding, pardon me. I'm not discounting that.
You're not being sarcastic at all.
No, I was being sarcastic at the fact that I could see how most people...
I was being sarcastic when I said that.
Okay.
Well...
But when Jesus said that what defiles a man is what comes out, and maybe what makes a man clean is also... What comes out of
and
man
I think Paul, some of Paul's writings speaks to that more. Because Paul addresses the community of Christ as holy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. That's what I was talking about with the community part of things, was that when it's hard for one individual to consider himself holy because his acts as an individual aren't touching anybody else. Yeah. They're not doing anything with anybody else. But in order to be holy, your inner, when they talk about somebody like that, they're talking about somebody that's interacted with literally millions of people through their interactions with somebody that's interacted to somebody else that's stemmed from their lifestyle or their humanity or what they've done.
So when we look at what Jesus is doing with his community of disciples, when we take into account what Paul's writing has to say about community and holiness, what I think is happening is that this whole idea of the gospel spreading, of evangelism and witnessing, is about going out and touching and making, you know, touching the unclean to make them holy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. To not to transmit those traditions and laws and rituals that divide.
Not even necessarily to transmit knowledge?
Not even to transmit knowledge, but to transmit those actions that bring people together, that bring healing and wholeness.
So rather than even trying to bring the story of God, you're just literally trying to bring a better life to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what...
You're just, I mean, if you're evangelistic Christians, you're going to places without water to help them get water, to just simply get them water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're not trying to feed their thirsty souls. You're going to actually feed and quench their thirsty bodies because that's the thing to do to help those people.
And the assumption in Christianity is we will give them water. And once we give them water, then they will listen to us, and we will...
Maybe they will, maybe they won't.
Yeah, right. But if the goal is to get them to listen to us, then maybe that's not what we're really looking for. Maybe the goal should be to get them water.
Yeah, well, what's interesting, I think, is that the crowds gather to hear Jesus' teaching because Jesus... primary teaching is for his disciples.
Mm-hmm.
Or he is being questioned by those in religious authority. He is responding to that. People seem to be interested in hearing about Jesus because of what he has done. But Jesus doesn't seem to necessarily focus on teaching the people.
Right.
He's just answering the questions that whoever happens to be there is curious about.
Yeah. Most of the time when he's teaching, he's not actually teaching people. What he's doing is fulfilling needs
so
for Mark.
He's fulfilling needs, and he's just teaching his disciples what a healing community looks like. And he's explained to his disciples why he is doing what he does.
Mm-hmm. It's not about everybody gather, there's going to be a sermon at 10 o'clock.
This would be a great way to prove whether or not people were actually learning something in class. Get them a baby to entertain while they're learning.
Even when Peter gets up after Pentecost and speaks to, 3,000, It's not because he goes there to speak.
Uh-huh.
It's because people have questions about what has happened.
Uh-huh.
People know he's there to respond to the accusations that the disciples are drunk.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right. Hey, you guys.
So what if they are? They're blowing off steam because they've been listening to me for 3 weeks straight. Or they just saw me walk on water and beat them to wherever it was we were going to. And I didn't stop. Okay.
Oh boy.
Okay.
So, now that's... passage is in the middle of this transition from Jewish to Gentile, because it's a key, as well as what the next story that comes. Because Jesus is destroying the barriers that have kept these two groups separate.
So, up until this point, he's just been talking to the Jews.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. He's had a little visit over to the other side.
Uh-huh.
But here, Mark places this here to give it a literary climax.
Uh-huh.